God made the world and all its wonders for man to explore. And there are countless wonders just outside your front door. Now join natural world photographer and journalist Roger W. Downs as he shares the stories of the people, places, music, and cuisines he has discovered as we explore with RWD.
Hey, welcome back into another episode. I'm Roger W. Downs, your host. I'm a wildlife and natural world photographer and also a journalist. And in this podcast, what I like to do is share the stories behind the people and places that I discover as I go out to photograph the artistry that God has given us. And with that said, let me just start this podcast by saying thank you, Lord, for another chance to share my story and the stories of others and hopefully inspire people to get out and explore your world that you've given us. Get away from the Xboxes and the PlayStations and get out from behind that desk and go out and explore. So I was doing just that about a month ago when I stumbled into the DuPont State Recreational Forest. Now, I'd been there before and traveled along the path that took you to Hooker Falls, Triple Falls, and High Falls, and I loved that hike. Unfortunately, once I wandered back into the forest and went to the Hooker Falls path because I just wanted to go down there, hang out, take some photos, I noticed that the path that I usually took along the little river that hugged the riverbank, unfortunately, had been closed because people throughout the summer have been going down there with their coolers and so forth and leaving trash behind. And the Forest Service said, well, that's enough of that. So they rerouted the path to Hooker Falls way around the ridge and then back down to the falls, hopefully to discourage people from hauling coolers and all that along that longer trek, which I think is probably going to work. But if you take the New Hooker Falls Trail, you'll get to a point where it Ys off. Now, if you go off to the right, it'll take you down to the falls. If you go to the left, it'll take you into the Hooker Moore Cemetery, which was established in the mid-1800s. And I love old cemeteries because they always have a tale to tell. So as I walked into the cemetery, I noticed that there were 5 new gravestones there. A lot of the other gravestones were just rocks that were kind of turned up to mark the grave. And there was a few other ones, probably from wealthy families that stood there. But no grave markers that were modern, except for 5. And the first grave that I saw had the name Isaiah Keith on it. And he lived to about 85. Obviously, the father of the 4 other graves. And they were marked with his children's names, and they all died within 18 days of each other. And I thought, something horribly tragic happened here. And my heart sank for Isaac. I could only imagine the pain that he and his wife went through, burying 4 of their children within 18 days of each other. So I was compelled to find out more. So after I was done hiking in the DuPont State Recreational Forest and hanging out at Hooker Falls, I came home and I reached out to friends of the DuPont State Recreational Forest. And they said, oh yeah, you need to chat with Patty Stahl. She's one of the living relatives of Isaiah Heath. And that is how I got her to be a part of this podcast. And she's going to share the story of Isaiah Heath and the DuPont State Recreational Forest from back in the day, because there is so much more to that story than just the tragedy that struck her family. And she's up next on Explore with RWD.
Explore with RWD will be right back after this.
Hey, RWD here with you, and I want to thank you for listening in with the Explore with RWD podcast, where we explore new areas, find out the history behind them, and also share the imagery. But that's a little hard when you're listening, right? So you can see a lot of the imagery that we capture while we're out exploring different areas, including videos as well, by following us on your favorite social media, which includes Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram. Just find us at Explore with RWD. I think you'd be pleasantly surprised. Again, that's at Explore with RWD.
Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
And now, as promised, our guest today, local historian and living relative of Isaac Heath, it is Patty Stahl. Patty, thank you so much for coming on the podcast with us to talk about your family.
Glad to be here and glad to help out and give you some more information on my family.
So before we get to the very tragic portion of Isaac Heath's life, can we talk a little bit about who he was as a person?
He was a farmer who lived in the current DuPont Forest area. We called it Buck Forest. Most people called it Buck Forest for many, many years, and the locals here will still call it Buck Forest oftentimes. But he was a farmer there, and he is my three times great-grandfather. And he started acquiring property there in the 1840s. It was granted 100 acres by the state of North Carolina and went on to buy more property there. And he married a local girl, Jane Shipman Heath. Her family name is still a major name in the Brevard and Cedar Mountain area. And they started their life together there and raised 10 children. And those children will be our big part of our discussion.
So when I walked through the Hooker Moore Cemetery and I saw those five gravestones and four of them with 1861, I believe it was, as the date of their death, I knew something tragic had to have taken place. Can you share what that story is?
Yes, I'll be glad to. And also I want to set the scene a little bit with what the community was like, because most people visiting there now assume it has always been just a large natural forest with a place for people to come and enjoy the waterfalls and the river. But it was a thriving community back in the mid-1800s. And Isaac was, of course, there. But the major landowner there was Micaiah Thomas. And he had built a large hotel, which we can discuss later, that drew people from all over the southeast to come and make a long trip out of it. And he had the post office. He received the post office permission to have the first post office in Transylvania County there, in Cedar Mountain, excuse me, there. And he also had the charter for a turnpike road to go right alongside. This was a different road from today's road. When you drive through DuPont Forest today, you are not on the Little River Turnpike. If you're on the Cascade Lake Road, that is the closest to the Little River Turnpike that still remains. So they had that major road there instead of going through the middle of the waterfalls as the road does now. And they had a school and they had a small church. And most every homeowner in that area was a farmer. There weren't a lot of cash businesses around. And so they raised their own crops, they raised their own animals, and they lived off of that. But they did have two grist mills in the area, and they also had sawmills to take advantage of all the lumber to build their homes and burn for their fires and things like that. So it was a thriving little community. We have newspaper accounts of the various farms and how the people entertained and, you know, how they lived and some of the tragedies that happened there and some of the funny things that happened there. But Isaac and his wife, Jane, were there in the middle of it. And they had 10 children. And by 1861, Isaac was 54 years old and Jane was 45. Mm-hmm. And of their 10 children, two had already moved out. And my great-great-grandfather was one of those two. They had established their own marriages and their own homes, although they were in the vicinity, but they weren't living in the home.
Right.
And unfortunately, an illness struck the family and maybe other families in the area. The family history book says that it was probably diphtheria, which is a bacterial disease, and that the children began to get sick. And on November the 30th, the first child that died was Harriet, and she was 7 years old.
Wow.
And so Isaac carried her to the Moore Cemetery. At that time, the Hookers did not even live here, so it was called just the Moore Cemetery at that time. And he carried her there, and buried her alone because he did not want to spread the disease to other people that might want to help him or even other family members.
Right.
Now, did he build the coffins, as they were called then, himself, or did he dig the grave himself? He very well may have, or it could be that neighbors in the community may have helped with those parts of the sickness where they couldn't help, you know, and be there in the home. We do know that his son later became a coffin maker just for people in the community for free. And so, you know, it sounds like he might have had that ability passed on down to him from his father, but that's speculation. But then within just another, well, on the 11th and the 12th, there's a little discrepancy. Either two of the children died on the same day, which would be Hannah, who was 17, and Martha was 5. They died either on the same day or one day apart. There's a discrepancy between the tombstone and the family Bible there. But those were two young girls that he had to then take out and bury them also. And then on December 17th of that same year, 1861, the son Millard, who was 12 years old, passed away. And of course, Isaac took him out there also and buried him in the cemetery. And of course, not knowing if that would be the end, there were still 6 more children at home. But fortunately, we know that that he was the last of the 4, and you know, they were able to go on with their lives. But I'm sure it was just a very sad place for quite a while, missing those 4 children, you know, within 18 days of each other, and having them out there in the cemetery. And they just put up, as everybody used to, unless you had some money, field stones, which are just basically local flat stones, mm-hmm. although they're not totally flat. You saw them in the cemetery yourself, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And they would etch, as it turns out, down the road, and I'll tell you this story later, they did notice the dates, just the dates of the death on those. And from that and from the family Bible, they put together which child went with which stone and went from there. As you know, Isaac lived until 1895, but he requested all that time that he be buried in that cemetery with those 4 children, and so he was. His wife is buried at Rocky Hill Baptist Church Cemetery, which is another church in the area, and she was a member there, but she was living with her son at that time, and so she's buried in that cemetery.
What a sad story. Just hearing you relate it, I'll be honest with you, it kind of tears me up thinking about having to lose 4 children. I have 6 myself. Losing even 2 of them, which would be relative to that equation, I can't imagine what he must have gone through it, and having to bury them himself. Unbelievable pain.
It is. And it happened actually one other time, because Micaiah Thomas, who was the owner of the hotel, he had 3 children himself that had died in the 1850s there in the forest of diphtheria, is the account for that family also. And they are buried together, and the only description we have is that they're buried on a knoll overlooking the original family home, which we think was near the hotel. Mm-hmm. And we've looked around for those 3 graves, but have not come across 3 alone. There have been other graves located throughout the forest, and people are always telling folks who are out just, you know, exploring, keep your eyes open. You may find a grave or several graves in the forest, because you know, there were no mortuaries as such around here at that time, and people had to pretty much be buried, you know, close to where they died. And so those 3 children are somewhere out there, and you know, maybe we'll be able to find their graves at some point, but as of right now, we don't know where they are in the property.
Now, I know we deal I know we deal with COVID right now, but what I think people don't understand is, unfortunately, I think it was like 1 in 7 children died of some sort of disease back then. And
sure.
And some families, of course, had it much worse than others, but on the average, it was 1 in 7 from measles, from diphtheria, from some disease that they did not have medication for. And I can only imagine, again, and I don't want to sound I'm being repetitive, but just it just completely leaves me flabbergasted to think about that kind of pain and how you pick yourself up and continue on after that.
But they did, didn't they? And
they
that
did.
Is the remarkable part. I mean, you know, the vaccine for diphtheria was developed in the 1920s, so we no longer have to face those kinds of things. And we kind of are don't think about them until something like COVID comes around. And, of course, my first thought was back to Isaac and the children and losing the children. This particular pandemic doesn't seem to affect the children as much, but often these earlier diseases did affect the children more so, certainly in this case, than the adults. And you're right, their little lives were just beginning, and they're already taken away. And it's just, no matter how many children you have, whether you have 10 or, in the case of Clinton Moore, who also is buried in the cemetery. He had 14 children. So,
wow.
You know, but you prize every one of those children.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know it was a sad time for them. They lost another son in 1868, and I don't know his cause of death. He had already been married and had children, but he also did pass away before either of his parents did. So they were no strangers to death, certainly. And had to just keep on going. And you know, their children that lived, grew up, and became wonderful members of the community. Some went out west, as people used to do, you know, with all the free land that was out there. Some of them went out west, but some of the Heath stayed here. And like I say, one of them became a squire and magistrate is what that means, basically, and started a new church. And so they still have relatives here today who are influential and productive, wonderful citizens. And this is just a story for us that brings us closer to them, to think about him doing that all on his own and being so close to those children. And we don't even often talk about Jane, but you can imagine that she nursed them through this illness. And then, you know, did they have a proper funeral? We don't know that. We don't have any indication of whether they were able to do that at some point later on down the road, or whether life just went on and that was it. And that's another comparison to today, actually, where, you know, we're not holding proper funerals as we normally would because of the fear of exposure to the COVID. So it's an interesting part of history, but also a very sad story for the family, and yet a story for, you know, to let you know how people can go on and live from there. And they did not ever have any more children. The ones that, you know, that were remaining, like I said, out of the eight that were living with them, you know, half of them were gone. So they raised those other four, and then the two older ones were already out on their own. So, you know, that's basically the story of Isaac and his family. Now, remember, of course, that's the first year of the Civil War. And so they had just had the first shots fired at Fort Sumter earlier that year in April. And that's all beginning to happen, too, in the area, you know, where men are beginning to look at enlisting. And as you and I have discussed, do they go with the Confederate side, which you would automatically think they would? But some went to the Union side and went into Tennessee to the Knoxville area, which had a Unionist population, and joined over there. So Isaac's son Jackson did go the next year, but he joined the Confederate Army and served there for 2 years, took his own horse and his own gun, and so they paid him more because he did that. And and he served there until the war was over, and then he came back here.
Can you imagine? Well, let me think about this for a second, because what I love about chatting with people like you, Patty, is that history starts to come alive and you start to realize not just the facts about it, but the emotion behind it. So
exactly.
Here's Isaac, and he's just buried four of his own children, and now his son is off to war. And I mean, I can't even imagine. You've just gone through this horrible tragedy, and now you're like, is my son going to come home or not? Unbelievable. And I mean, talk about strength and fortitude. I'm sure he had ups and downs, but he continued to move forward through his life. He lived to 80 some years old, didn't he?
Right. Yes, he did. 85. And so, you know, he lived a long life. And we have a picture of him in his old age and of Jane as a couple, the two of them, which we're very happy to have. But, you know, kind of a gaunt faced, white bearded, white haired person. My uncle leads a lot of these hikes with me and with our friend Charlie Burden, who is a professor. Or was a professor. He's retired now. And sometimes the people will look at the photo because I have a handout with our hikes. And one couple looked at it and said, oh, I see a definite resemblance between Isaac and your Uncle Doug, who would be Isaac's great-great-grandson. And so that's kind of fun to see that through somebody else's eyes, you know, and to bring this history to other people who just think they're coming to a forest and not realizing they're coming to a place that was a community, and then later, a tourist area, and then a manufacturing plant, and now it's a recreational forest. So
right.
It's kind of a fun thing for them to learn and to experience.
It's changed.
And to think about, yeah.
I was going to say, it's changed so much. I mean, over the last, 20 years, it really has. And even 50, 60 years, there's been so much change in the DuPont State Recreational Forest. But let's talk a little bit about that community, because I know there's a lot of history in that, too. So, just for people who may have missed it, what was the name of the town then?
Well, a lot of people call the area Buck Forest.
Okay.
That's what most people refer to it. Now, it was also called Cedar Mountain, and that's going to confuse even some local people because Cedar Mountain now is about 2 to 3 miles away from DuPont State Recreational Forest. But the original community named themselves after what we call Cedar Rock. And anyone that hikes or looks at the map of DuPont State Recreational Forest will see Cedar Rock. Mm-hmm. But originally it was called Cedar Mountain. And so they named themselves after that mountain. And this area where I live now, which is on Reasonover Road, very near the Fawn Lake entrance to DuPont Forest, is considered Cedar Mountain, but back then it would not have been. It really wasn't even heavily settled. Buck Forest was more heavily, it was more heavily settled originally. And so the people living out there called it Cedar Mountain. The hotel that Mackijah Thomas built was often called Cedar Mountain Hotel. And he had, like I said, the post office in the hotel for Cedar Mountain. Mm-hmm. It's listed if you look in the listings of all the post offices in Transylvania County. It's listed as Cedar Mountain, but it's listed at Buck Forest. And he had, like I mentioned earlier, the turnpike that you had to pay to travel along, especially the tourists and the business people and the drovers mm-hmm. coming through the community. They would have to stop and pay a toll right there near the hotel, actually, is where they would collect the toll on this end of the road. Of course, that also meant he was responsible for the upkeep of that road to be able to collect that toll and to have that charter. The charter was granted to other folks also, and they, I imagine, maintained different sections of the road because some of them were at the other end down near what we call the Little River community today. But the hotel was there, and it was large. It had 32 rooms. It had a ballroom. It had a piazza, which is a huge front porch where they would dance and play games. And mm-hmm. He built the tower on what we call Cedar Rock so people could climb up and get an even better view. And, of course, the waterfalls were a big draw for people that were staying there, the hunting and the fishing. And this is all written up in quite a few newspaper accounts and in a book called The Land of the Sky by Christian Reed. She fictionalizes it, but she bases it on the actual hotel and the actual area, and she writes about some of the things that people would do, and she puts conversation in, and it's a lot of fun to read from that time period. But he had quite a place going out there for himself, and then all the other folks that lived around him, I'm sure, you know, were influenced by the hotel and maybe even supplied some of the food or some of the services or some of the guides for some of the trips. So it probably was a good thing money-wise for the whole community out there. But like I said, they had their church. Laurel Creek Church was there. The Thomases had their own chapel near their hotel that they used to worship. But they would have dances, and they would have what we call taffy pullings, where they make the sorghum molasses, and then the whole community gathers to do that, to strip the cane and to crush the cane, and then the kids play on the cane pile, and then the sorghum, or molasses as it's called here, was made, and then it cools and you pull it to make taffy. That was just a big social time in the fall, usually, in the community. And so they had a lot of experiences like that, you know, doing those kinds of things and just raising their families and raising their crops and, you know, taking care of each other as a neighborhood. It was, sounds like it was a great place to live. And then the Civil War came along and did change some of that. And, you know, it was a sad story for Micaiah Thomas because his sons-in-law were killed during the war. His sons survived, although one of them was blinded in the POW camp in Chicago and came back home and still, you know, had his farm, but of course was affected. And then Micaiah himself, towards the end of the war, was attacked and beaten at the hotel. His sons and sons-in-law were gone, and these men came in, whether they were Kirk's Raiders, which was a Union group, or whether they were just some of the scalawags from around here that would go hide out in the woods and not go to the war themselves, but rob and beat and burn the women and children and the older men like Micaiah that were still living there. And that's what happened to him. And they took everything out of the house. Even one account that we have, even the little child was sitting there with a blanket and they ripped her blanket out from under her. That account comes from the family themselves. But they were beating him about the head with the butt of a gun, and his 15-year-old daughter threw herself on him. So he was not killed, but he was blinded, and that's documented in the census after that, that it states that he was blind in all the later census reports. And so they ran the hotel for a while, but the family says he lost all desire to do that after his beating, so he sold it to a character named Joe Carson, and they built another home across the other area of Little River, still in Bud Forest, and lived there until, for many, many years. He dies later on, of course, and is buried in the other cemetery out at DuPont Forest. But his children stayed on there for a while, but as you know from Danny's earlier report, they all eventually sold out to the Cox estate, the Cox family, and all those private homes were gone at that point.
Right, and then the Cox sold it over to DuPont, I think.
Exactly, exactly. But Joe Carson kept the hotel going until really by 1900 it was starting to go downhill. He was older. He wasn't really able to keep it up and entertain people. He would often send people knew of the hotel and knew of its history, and they would still come through and sometimes camp there or stop there and visit, and he would send them on into what we now consider Cedar Mountain to stay with my great-great-grandfather or other people out here. And another hotel was finally built in Cedar Mountain. And throughout all of this time, the Cedar's Head Hotel was always there, and it's another big draw to this area was the Cedar's Head Hotel itself. But certainly while the hotel was there and the families were there, even into the 1900s, there are newspaper accounts in the Sylvan Valley News and the Brevard News and the Transylvania Times about what was happening in Buck Forest, the Buck Forest News, and it's just delightful to read those and read about the things, and some of them are very gossipy, and some of them are just, you know, who traveled where and what kind of snake they killed that day, and a rabid dog bit somebody at Hooker Shoal, you know, we know it as Cornmeal now, Cornmeal Shoals, but they had a meal there also, and just fun things that let you know what life was like back then, you know, in that area. So it faded away, and the turnpike was no longer used as much, although that road was used by DuPont workers who started coming from Hendersonville. They came up that old gravel road until Staten Road was built either late 60s or early 70s. So that old turnpike road was still being used when DuPont came in, and for folks driving from Hendersonville. Yeah. They didn't want to come all the way through Brevard and come in from that way. But lots of wonderful stories about Buck Forest and people traveling there, and the cemeteries. And of course, the Union soldier who is buried in the Hooker Moore Cemetery. That's been another interesting story that's been well reported, throughout the years.
Share that story with us, because I love that one too. That one really intrigued me, and it's very sad as well.
It is. And when you are in the cemetery, and I went just the other day again, takes me about 10 to 15 minutes to get there. So I went and walked up just to take some more photographs and to just see how things were going since they've moved and put the new path to Hooker Falls right alongside a cemetery. It used to, as you know, because you didn't even discover the cemetery until recently when you hiked the new trail. It used to be up on top of that knoll by itself, and it was a quiet little place, and you just felt like you were in a special place when you were there. And so now it's exposed more to everybody that will be going to Hooker Falls. But that's okay. As long as, they're respectful of it, it'll be an interesting history lesson for them, too, and then even more than that for other people. But I walked in, and I was, checking out some of the graves that we've been studying. And just to the left and up a row of two from Isaac's grave is the grave that belongs to James Lewis Sentell. And we know from the 1860 census that he was living out there in Buck Forest with his wife Melinda, and they had several children already, according to that census. But then when the war came along, for whatever reason, he decided to go ahead and enlist, although most people did. And according to Ancestry, he enlisted with the Confederate Army first. And whether they've got this correct or not, but it says he enlisted on April the 13th of 1863 in Brevard as a private with the 62nd Infantry. But we know that by October, he definitely was enlisted in Knoxville, Tennessee as a private with the North Carolina 2nd Mounted Infantry, Muster Company F, on the Union side. And we know that he later on in 1864, in May of 1864, he was coming back this way. The family story is to check on his wife. There was a child either to be born. Well, the child was born in May, so I imagine he was coming back for the birth of the child. Mm-hmm. And he was traveling with another cousin, a Sentell cousin, and a friend, and they were traveling back here. And apparently they got to South Hominy, which is an area near Candler, North Carolina, still in Buncombe County, but not right at Asheville. Right. And they were traveling through there. And the account states that they stopped at a spring. Now, anybody that knows much about traveling along the old roads and the turnpike roads and the drover's roads, you would know that the springs were natural gathering places. You stop there to get fresh water. You stop there to water your animals. Oftentimes there will be some sort of lodging there near those springs, especially the larger ones. And so they stopped there. Now, whether they were being careful about it, I don't know. But the Confederates were watching the springs, apparently. And there was a skirmish, and they killed all three of the men at that place. It's also affiliated with the church. The church is called Pisgah Methodist Church. Okay. And so they were killed. And the story is that the locals in the area went ahead and dug three shallow graves there and buried the men. And then obviously the family was informed, and they came and got the men. Later research found that Daniel Gilbert, the friend, was actually buried there in that church cemetery that is there where they were killed. The other two young men, the Sentell men, were brought back this way, and the cousin was buried in another cemetery in Transylvania County, but James Lewis was buried in the Moore Cemetery. And in researching all of that, I found where the federal government would issue tombstones for the soldiers that were killed in battle. And I found the record for James Lewis Sentell of the North Carolina Mounted Infantry. And he, it says he is at Moore Cemetery at Grange, North Carolina, which is another name from the community of Little River today.
Right.
And that his headstone was supplied by the Gross Company in Lee, Massachusetts, contracted 1896. When the headstone was delivered, I don't know, but I wouldn't imagine it was too long after that. And that is the headstone that is currently in, that you will see there in the cemetery. Now, the family maintains from years ago that he was actually buried outside of the cemetery. The first thing you want to think is, well, maybe because he went over to the Union Army. But we don't know that. We've not found a grave outside of the cemetery at this point. So did they move, did they actually bury the body where the tombstone is now, or did they move it and erect a new tombstone, or is the body still somewhere outside and the tombstone is just there? I did check to see if there has been any sinking in front of the tombstone, which usually signifies there is a grave there, especially an old grave. You know, those old wooden caskets rot. And, you know, the graves start to sink in unless someone maintains them. There is a little bit of that, but it's not as pronounced as in other graves. So it's still a mystery whether he is buried there with that tombstone or somewhere outside of the cemetery. As far as we know, that's the point now. The fence that's around the cemetery was, we don't believe there was a fence there originally. That was erected later on by the Forest Service or volunteers. I'm not sure which. It's John Carney, who did so much of this research much earlier on. He says the Forest Service put up that fence. But I know the volunteers maintain the fences at this point in time. So, you know, and trees are growing everywhere there now, whereas back in the day, a lot of those trees would have been harvested. And so yeah. When you look at some of the older pictures, you don't see nearly the number of trees that you see today because people cut them down, you know, especially the chestnuts before they were all gone. You know, they were a huge product that was taken out and sold, and people built with it and burned it and, you know, sold it for all kinds of things. So it's a good chance that that cemetery maybe stood out at one time up there on that little knoll, you know, without all the large forests around it. We don't know for sure, but, you know, it's and the little church that was associated with it was just about a half a mile away, and it is now covered by Cascade Lake.
Oh,
because,
okay.
Because as the Cascade Lake Dam was built, at the time of Isaac, it was not built. There was no lake there. There was no dam there. It was just Little River going over the Hamilton Shoals down there. But when they did build the dam there, and they kept making it higher and higher and making it from wooden to concrete, and the last time they made it higher, of course, the lake backed up farther, and it was going to back up to the point where it flooded part of the old Turnpike Road and also the location of the church. And so whether they moved the church or whether they tore it down, people just didn't let lumber sit there and deteriorate. They would take it and use it somewhere.
Right.
And so whatever they did with the church, the location of the original church was flooded. And the school, it was a school also in the same building. And they either moved the building or they built a new one on the banks of Cascade Lake. Now, it's no longer there either. But that is the church that was also affiliated with that cemetery. And we believe Isaac was a member there, but all of those records are gone. We have not been able to find any of the records from Laurel Creek Church, which we could, and maybe we will eventually, but it just makes sense that he probably went to church there since he was living right in that area and owned property right in that area. So James Lewis Sentell is still there. And, you know, the discussion about why would someone in the South join the Union Army, that happened a good bit here in Cedar Mountain. It looks like maybe 8 to 9% of the men that enrolled in the enlisted in the Confederate Army in Transylvania County went over and joined the Union Army afterwards. And you know, these were all small farmers. They weren't plantation owners. They weren't slave owners. They really weren't really invested in the war as much as some of the local, more lower South places.
Right.
And so, you know, whether they just saw what was happening or their hearts just weren't in it, or they just felt like they would be better protected to serve the Union Army, we don't know. But that's certainly what James Lewis Sentell did, whether he just went straight to them or whether he did enlist in one and then desert and go to the other one. That's a part of history we don't know yet, but we know that he's buried in there in the cemetery. And, you know, that that sad story, you know, gives us another part of that community too. And his family stayed on there. They're listed in some of the later census reports. She's still there. She becomes the head of household, Melinda does, and raises those children there herself. And the reason it's called the Moore Cemetery, and I need to mention this, Clinton Moore, who originally owned the property, Hooker Falls,
right,
and he built a grist mill there, and it was called the Moore Mill, and everybody brought their corn or their wheat or whatever to be ground there. And so that mill, of course, was very close to the cemetery. So whether it was originally to be his private family cemetery or whether they just called it that because it was close to the mill, and he ends up being, he and his wife and a daughter-in-law, I believe, are buried there. So I don't know why it was called the Moore Cemetery except for those reasons. And then later, he sold the Hooker Falls property to the Hooker brothers, three brothers, although two of them backed out and the one brother stayed. And he built another mill on the other side of Little River and ran that mill for a number of years until they sold the property to the Coxes. And that family of the Hooker son moved into what is Cedar Mountain today. And I grew up knowing two of the old bachelor sons that remained from that family here in Cedar Mountain that were quite the characters, the local characters for all of us.
They always are, so, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are two old bachelor guys that were quite characters here in Cedar Mountain, kind of a local legend for Cedar Mountain people. But and so Clinton Moore is buried there, and his wife. They have originally, when my cousin Alton Taylor and his wife Billy started looking at the cemetery, knowing from the family history that we had family buried there, and they went out and found the cemetery terribly overgrown and, you know, just trees fallen, and they started cleaning and looking, and they found these 65 graves. Only six of them had what you and I would consider an actual grave marker. Most of them were the rocks, you know, that had been turned up on their side with maybe something scratched into it. And they started looking at all of those and found just about six of them that had markings that were easy to read. And then they went back with cornstarch, which is a common practice in the past, and sprinkled it on all the other field stones. And that's when they found three that matched the dates of the children in the Heath family that died. And of course, were they ever thrilled to find those. And from there, they realized that the fourth one had been covered with this huge laurel bush that had grown over it. They never did find a stone. They're thinking it was moved somehow, or the roots of the bush grew over it. And I don't know. They didn't dig down because they don't want to disturb a grave, of course.
Of course.
But then they found a very large fieldstone, which they assumed was Isaac's. They don't know that for a fact, but they know he's not with his wife at the other cemetery. They know he requested to be buried there. So they started looking around at all of the rocks and trying to figure out who they were. But it was kind of abandoned at that point. And they did a lot of work and were given a lot of credit for, you know, bringing it back to shape and a place where people could go and see their family. But Clinton and his wife, they have a tall tombstone, and it's very obvious there mm-hmm. in the cemetery. So, you know, it's just amazing to stand there and look at all those small rocks turned up on their side and wonder. The oldest one that's marked is 1859, but how many of them might even be older than that, you know, that are buried there is the thing you would love to know more about. We do know of one infant that died in the Butte Forest area. The family was here visiting from Greenville, and the infant died, and they buried the child there. That's from one of those newspaper accounts. Right. And we can't find a marker with her name, but we know she's there somewhere in that cemetery. And they, you know, it was too, they wouldn't be able to carry the body home, even to Greenville, because of the heat and because of the distance. At that time, it wasn't just an hour's drive, you know, to get to Greenville. It was down Jones Gap with a horse and buggy, and it took usually 2 days to get all the way into Greenville. So,
I wonder if those parents ever came back to that cemetery then to visit her gravesite.
I would think so. It was a family. I think the last name was Andrews. Mm-hmm. And they had family in that area. So they were visiting family when she died. So I would assume they would have come back. But it is interesting that we don't know, but just really, you know, 10 to 20 of those graves. And where are all the families of those people, you know, that we don't have all that information from them. But it just goes to show you how life was, like you said. You worked hard. And you did what you had to do to survive, and children died, and you buried them, and then you had to keep on going. And oftentimes families would move away, especially, we know they all moved away finally out of Butte Forest. So, you know, those stories get lost, and people don't even realize there's still a cemetery out there until it's publicized. So,
well, I was really surprised to find it myself, and I knew that there were cemeteries not only in the DuPont State Forest, but also the Pisgah National Forest, because I'd heard stories of them. But when I stumbled across it for the first time, I'm always fascinated with cemeteries, because that's the first thing that comes to mind is, like, what is the story behind these people? And when I found your great-great-great-grandfather, right? Or did I miss a great?
Yes, that's it. No, you got it. Okay. Three times great.
Yeah, three times great-grandfather, and his children laid out there, and, of course, four of them all passing in the same year. I knew that there had to be an interesting story, which you've shared with us, of course. And those are the sort of things when you're walking through and you're like, I'm going to go down and see Hooker Falls and sit down there and watch the falls come over the cliff and pray to God, because that's what I like to do when I'm down there.
And, exactly.
And when you come across that and just you think, who used to live here? And like you said, there was a thriving community there, which you really don't see any part of anymore, minus that cemetery.
Right. That's right. You don't. And there was the one, as you're looking upstream at Hooker Falls, that the gristmill was on the left, and the Hooker Cemetery, gristmill, here I do it again, was on the right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have great pictures of it, which is wonderful. You can see the wheel, you know, that, you know, the stone is inside of there. We know that the millers would charge the people coming in. Not money, but they would keep so much of the corn or whatever they were grinding as their pay. We know that when the Moors sold their property to the Hookers, in the deed it states that both the Moors, he and his wife, would be allowed to come and grind at any time for free. So they put the little extra thing in there, you know, in there for themselves. And we know that even after the Hookers were no longer running the mill, that another couple came in and operated it later on for people to come and bring. And you know there had to be, I'm sure the millstones were taken out. Those were pretty highly prized and fairly expensive. And you see those in people's homes in their yards today where they've been taken from places. But I'm sure the millstones were taken out right away. But the structures, some of the structures probably were there. My uncle, who lived at Cascade Lake as a teenager for a while, he would often go and just look around in there to see if he could find any of the old parts of the mill or just any of the old foundation pieces or something. But there's not any of that left that he's been able to find. Now, this was many, many years ago. You wouldn't go looking for that now since it's a forest.
Right.
But back when it was DuPont had just acquired it at that time. It's when he was in there looking. He would come up the lake and come up from the Cascade Lake Hotel and in a boat and come up that way and check it all out then. That was a different approach to it. But, it's amazing. There were houses, and we have pictures of the Hooker cabin and some of the other cabins that were in there, they're all gone now. The Coxes were going to use some of them for some of their customers who would come there to hunt and fish, but eventually DuPont took them all down, or either they just fell into disrepair.
Right.
And, you know, DuPont went on to build lakes and you know, put in new roads and make it a wonderful place to work. My husband worked there for many years, and it was a wonderful place to work and to have a chance to use those lakes and the forests and the waterfalls too.
Yeah, from what I understand, DuPont really took care of their employees.
They did. And like I say, I actually, after doing a presentation one time, a lady asked me, she said, "Were you not upset when this big manufacturing firm came into this beautiful forest?" And I said, "Oh, no." I said, in the 1950s, the people were thrilled to have an employer who would come in and pay wonderful wages and offer benefits. And it was a healthy place to work. And, you know, it was, we needed it badly in this area. You know, we just were, you know, just needed that kind of employment. There, Acosta, of course, in town was offering some of that and a few other businesses. But, and they took such good care. It wasn't like they came in and, you know, trashed the place. They took such wonderful care of the environment. And are still having to take care of some parts of it, you know, as they turn it over to the state. So, but it's been a wonderful place to live and a beautiful place to live. And then in addition to that, to have the family history, to think about family members that walked in that cemetery, you know, and that are buried in that cemetery and all over that area, it just makes you feel closer.
Yeah.
To the place that you live when you can experience that.
Yeah. Right, right. And DuPont was really good to the land, too, and a good neighbor to the community. Because after they ceased operations there in the DuPont State Forest, they tore down that plant brick by brick, making sure it didn't damage the environment. And that's also in Danny Bernstein's book, DuPont Forest, A History. And we chatted with her last week in Episode 8 of Explore with RWD. But, Patty, when we come back, I want to talk to you about the Turnpike and all the ins and outs behind it, and exactly where did it run through Western North Carolina?
No wonder off now. Explore with RWD will be right back after this.
Natural world photographer Benjamin Wall.
When I was in Alaska at one stage taking photographs of the grizzly bears on the Alaskan Peninsula, there was a bear that came out of the weeds. These really high grass, actually, just beside of me, and he was roaring and running right at me.
Be inspired by this story and others from Benjamin Walls in Episode 7 of Explore with RWD.
That wasn't too bad, now was it? Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
So, Patty, before we start talking about where the Turnpike ran in Western North Carolina, I'm sure people are wondering, who exactly is Patty Stahl? So let's start off with a very basic question, like, were you raised in this area?
I was. I moved away. My father had a business in Greenville. He drove the mountain to Greenville every day, and he became sick. And so for a few years, we rented a house in Greenville, but kept our home up here, and would come back every weekend and every summer and every holiday, but we were down there during the week. So for my high school years, I was at Greenville High School, but for the rest of my life, I've been here in Cedar Mountain. Married my husband, who was an engineer out at DuPont, and we are here on family property, and I taught school in Brevard for 30-some-odd years, drove the mountain to Furman University back and forth to get my degree down there. But I've been here, and my uncle has been here. He's 82. He's been here almost all the years of his life. And Academic Dr. Charlie Burden, who's helping us as we make this journey and acquire all this information and write this book. He has always been here since a young man. He came up with the Piedmont camp with his family and then with a summer home here, and he has a home in Sherwood Forest now also. So the three of us are just very close to Cedar Mountain, and you know, it just enjoy learning more about it ourselves, you know, that we didn't know all those years until we started doing more research.
So what did you teach?
I taught kindergarten for my entire career. Yeah, I taught children how to read, especially the last 10 to 15 years. You know, they were expected to be readers. So I taught kindergarten all those years.
I can see that, Patty. You have a very kind soul.
Well, thank you. It was a wonderful job. It really was. And of course, I work with the children in our church, and all of that works together. You know, when you have those abilities, they go everywhere with you. So it was a wonderful career, and getting to learn more about the Turnpike. The Turnpike is actually what I did not know much about, even growing up here in the community. And my uncle introduced me to all of that as we hiked the old roadbed from Cedar Mountain into Brevard, and you know, to learn all about that, and then the drovers that came through here bringing the hogs and the turkeys and the cattle and whatever else through this area to go to the markets in South Carolina, that was over by the time I was born, of course, and so that was totally new information to me and just fascinating to learn, you know, how that happened and how it came about, how it was used. So, you know, that's been a lot of fun to learn all that and do all of that.
Well, I know when I first moved here, I ran across a wagon train literally wandering along one of the, like, the back roads in the Pisgah National Forest. And they were reenacting people going to market. And they didn't have any animals with them per se, but they had horses pulling wagons and covered wagons and that sort of thing. And some people were riding along on tractors or whatever. And I just thought that was the coolest thing.
It makes you understand how they would, you know, get cash, you know, to sell those animals to, but you had to get them to a market to sell them. And so how did you do it? You had to just drive them, which is why of course, if I were to say that to a child today, they would think we put them in a vehicle and drove them, but it means you actually had to just physically walk along with them, or like you say, maybe use a wagon. But in most of our research, there were no wagons being used with these large groups of animals. It was just people at the front and people at the back and people on the sides driving them along, or, you know, they would follow a certain lead animal. I don't know exactly how that worked, but you know, they were taking them over these mountains and down into the cities of South Carolina to sell. And it was an amazing thing until a railroad came along, and then they could transport them by rail car, you know, so much easier and so much more profit too. But that's a big part of what we're discovering, is how that whole process worked, and the springs and the lodges and the places they would stop and spend the night, and the corn that was sold to them. I mean, out at Buck Forest, there would have been fields of corn. You look at that place now and you think, fields of corn, where? But there would have been fields of corn. They even talk about the fields of corn and the fields of wheat. Wheatfields Branch is right up there near the top of High Falls. And apparently there was wheat growing on both sides of the Little River above High Falls, you know, early on. And you know, people didn't just grow it for themselves. They grew it for their animals, and then they also grew it to sell. And, of course, some of it was actually made into moonshine, too, from time to time. So, who'd have thought? But that's an easy way to transport some produce to get some money for it. A lot easier than moving the cows along, I guess, would be, or the corn along would be to transport it that way.
Right.
But, you know, big fields, even as a girl growing up here in Cedar Mountain, and Cedar Mountain now, of course, runs along 276, but always cornfields everywhere you looked. And now you don't see those large cornfields up here anymore. You know, we just have small home gardens and that kind of thing. We don't have the big fields of corn like we used to in this area. And even in Brevard, a lot of them now are sod fields. You know, they sell the sod instead of the corn. So, changes come along, but that's what happens. That's what happened to Buck Forest. You know, the Civil War came along, the road system changed, and, you know, it turned into the Cox Estate and their tourism, and then, fortunately, DuPont came along and acquired it. And so that just happens to places.
It certainly does. So before I let you go, though, let's talk a little bit about the Turnpike and where it ran, because I thought it ran the same route as 276, but that's not exactly accurate.
Right. First of all, the Jones Gap Turnpike is the old road that you can hike now. It's now a part of the park system out there and at Caesar's Head. And it came from River Falls, South Carolina, up right along the Middle Saluda River up here to the headwaters of the Middle Saluda River, right to the state line between North and South Carolina. And people would travel up that way, and they would either come on into Cedar Mountain or they would turn back to the left and go out to Caesar's Head. You had to pay a toll at the bottom, and you had to pay a toll at the top, whichever way you were going. And then if they were traveling on through Cedar Mountain, which they would have, there was nowhere else to go, you would get on what we call the Johnstone Turnpike, although it also had other names depending on the stretch of property. And you would come on into Cedar Mountain, and then when you got several places, it would veer off. Almost right away, it veers away from 276 today. It was in a lower location, and it actually, at that point, intersected with the Green River Turnpike, which came over from the Green River section, which is out at the end of Reefanover Road. But at any rate, then it would continue on down, and it would go down towards the Summer Home Community, which we call part of it we call Hideaway, but it would veer away. The summer people that came up here after the Civil War and established their colony, they owned the property all the way up to this small creek. Well, the Turnpike, of course, wanted to avoid the creek and bridges and all those kinds of things.
Right.
So it went around on the other side of the creek, and whereas now 276 is straight there. And then the biggest, one of the biggest it moves that it made away from 276 was where it crossed Little River, because where 276 goes down and crosses Little River now was a marsh back then, and it flooded all the time because Little River was there, Clear Creek was there, and so it was a low marshy area. You would not put a road through that area back in the 1800s, and so the road actually went half a mile away, crossed the little river on the wooden bridge that fortunately we have pictures of from the late 1800s, and then went way around and crossed another river and then came in behind the current Cedar Mountain Community Center. And from that point on, it stayed parallel to 276 for a while, and then it would veer off again because Little River from here on out gets pretty close to 276. What happened with 276 is they actually straightened Little River in some places so they could build 276 as a straight road. And they raised, they made it like almost like a levee. 276 is almost like a levee. And Little River still floods, and you can drive down through there oftentimes and see the water on either side, or sometimes it actually floods 276. But the old Turnpike Road would have gone farther away and hugged the bottom of the mountains is what it would have done. And that's what it did. It would weave in and out wherever Little River would weave in, it would go out. Mm-hmm. And now they've straightened Little River, so that's not so much of an issue in several places. And even on into town, we tracked the Turnpike all the way into Brevard. And there are places where it does the same thing, where it hugs the bottom of the hills or the bottom of the mountains, because you're still fairly level there, but you've got more elevation, and you're away from the French Broad, because the French Broad also floods all the time.
Yeah,
all the time. And so 276 through there has been built up also, even more so over the years, because it still flooded this year. We had to go a different way to get into Cedar Mountain even this year because of the flooding along the French Broad. So But, you know, the places where you can see, I mean, it makes sense once you start looking at it and you can see, oh, this would not be where a road normally would go because you're right beside the river. You're looking at the river, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it would veer away. The turnpike, of course, was there before 276. 276 was originally 284. It was built as a state highway. And the state quickly, and it was actually called the Gear Highway originally, after the man that organized a lot of the money and the work that went into getting it made. But the federal government realized, hey, this is a pretty good road. Let's make it a federal highway. And of course now it's Federal Highway 276 all the way up, as you know, into Pisgah National Forest.
Right.
And it heads on up there to the Blue Ridge Parkway. So now it's a federal highway, but it was a turnpike for many years before the state decided to take over the roads, and people had to pay a fee, you know, as they travel along.
Yeah, and make sure people understand, too, that they didn't pay a fee to the government. They paid a fee to the people who oversaw the turnpike.
Exactly. The people that had the contract for that turnpike. And often it was the toll was collected either at the end of the turnpike or at a major point, like when the Little River Turnpike, which is the one that Mekhi Thomas built out there by the Buck Forest Hotel, it came on in here to today Cedar Mountain. And the Johnstone Turnpike, which was going to Brevard and then on up through Cedar Mountain, they came together right at the bridge that crosses Little River. And there was always a store there, and the post office was there at one time. Just a natural place for people to stop and pay the toll, but maybe also go inside the little store and buy something, or just a place to sit and gather and visit and catch up on the news from, you know, if you're coming up the Little River Turnpike out of Henderson County, what's happening over in Hendersonville today, you know, and
right.
You're getting the news from those people. And because, you know, we didn't have telephones. We actually didn't have telephones in Cedar Mountain until the 1950s.
Wow.
So, you know, people were, that's because DuPont, there were isolated phones in some of the businesses, but they were having all these campaigns in the communities to get phones out in the rural communities. And then when DuPont decided to come in, it's like, well, we don't even have to do it anymore. They'll have to for DuPont. And they did. And naturally, they wanted telephone service to DuPont. DuPont wanted that. So that's when Cedar Mountain got their phones for everybody in the community. You know, when you were able to have access to a party line phone, it was a party line at that time. People would gather in places to get information, like the toll gathering places or the bridges or the stores or, you know, that's how you found out what was happening in the other communities around you.
Always had to hear the latest gossip, I guess.
That's right. The latest gossip or, you know, what's going on in the political world, and not so much in the national politics, but, you know, local politics. Things in the other.
It really hasn't changed much if you think about it, because we gather in coffee shops. I mean, maybe not right now during COVID-19, but we do. We gather in coffee shops and little places like that. We go, so what's going on over in your neck of the woods? We still do
that
today.
That's right, we do. And churches, all kinds of places like that, we still do that. You're right.
Yeah, and I think it's just human nature. That's why probably social media is so popular, because now you can just post it online. Hey, I saw this. Here's a picture.
Right. And for that same reason, it was desirable to live close to the turnpike or the road, because it was a big event for people to come along and you stop and visit or offer them something to drink, because you wanted company. You wanted somebody to talk to, and they were looking for the same thing. And so, you know, now we build our homes way back up on the mountains. But if you look at the old roads, you see many, many home places just right on the road almost, uh-huh. You know, and you're thinking, why would somebody build right on the road? But hey, that's how you got a lot of information, and you didn't have to maintain a road, and, you know, it was just a different way of life.
I can imagine that somebody probably was like the person who had all the info. Like, let's go talk to Sally, because I bet you Sally knows what's going on, because her house is right there on the turnpike.
Right. or the postmistress.
Oh, right? Yeah,
that,
right.
That was often, yeah, that was often another, or the storekeeper. You know, the Cedar Mountain stores, there, you always had the old guy sitting out front on the benches, you know, just visiting all day long or checking out who was going by or, you know, who came in the store or what was happening. So a lot of times the old guys sat there longer than the old gals.
How neat is that? I just love hearing about it. It's almost like when you talk about it, Patty, it's almost like history comes back to life because we still do that today. We're still that relatable that we always want to connect with other people. And you think about how it happened like right before the Civil War. And I'm sure the news about the Civil War probably spread all over the mountains pretty quickly in that same fashion.
Right, right. And you know, the people, yeah, you know, people trying, coming back, going back and forth. I know my great-great-grandfather, Jackson, he came back for the, just like, I guess it was a common practice, just like James was trying to do, James Centel was trying to come back. He came back for the birth of one of his children, but the family story there is that he hid out in the woods, and she, if she was going to go into labor, she was supposed to ring the bell so he could come in. Now, he was eventually, you know, he eventually got out of the Confederate Army and got his pension and honorable discharge. So, you know, that didn't cause any problems for him. But you're right. I'm sure people coming through the mountains for whatever reason from these different places. There was never a battle fought in Transylvania County with right. the war, with the Civil War. But there were certainly a lot of those things happening where the, you know, the people coming through the Scalawags and some of those others were attacking people, but then other people just moving through, I'm sure, were trying to get news of their boys, you know, and what was happening with their boys. And you know, so many of them were in on both sides, were in the prisoner of war camps and, you know, terrible diseases and worried about their families back home, many of them wanting to get back home. And you know, many of them came home to farms that were ruined.
Yeah.
You know, so that was starting all over again in these small little communities that, you know, it just changed life for them, for many of them at that point. Many more stories of things that, I mean, we have several stories besides the one of Makaja Thomas of other people with hotels and businesses losing their businesses. They were burned to the ground or, you know, destroyed. By the other, and sometimes it would be neighbors, even neighbors against neighbors, unfortunately. But you're right, the word traveled through the mountains on, you know, what was happening with the soldiers. And I'm sure when one came back, Franklin Thomas, the son of Makaja, he was very ill, but he still stayed in the service, but he wasn't able to really fight or anything, so he would come back often and share news of what was happening with the other boys who were out there, you know, in actually in the fighting. So, yeah, people got news where they could back then.
Wow. Just amazing. And Patty, thank you so much for your time. Again, if you're just kind of popping in and out of this podcast, Patty Stahl is our guest. Now, I do want to talk about the book that you're writing and also the fact that you give tours, and you'll get back to that once we get past COVID-19, I'm sure.
Exactly. But, yes, but we will.
But let's talk about the book, because that's fascinating to me, because you're such a wealth of knowledge about the DuPont State Recreational Forest and the area right there surrounding it. So what inspired you to start writing this book?
Well, in 2011, Transylvania County had its sesquicentennial, which is, it means 150 years since it was organized. Mm-hmm. And so each little community had its own weekend to kind of highlight what had happened in their communities for 150 years. And Cedar Mountain, we actually had two events because we were fortunate enough to have a wealth of information. And we had one event at the community center and one event at the church family life center. And we had exhibits galore and we had artifacts. We have a huge summer community that has been coming, like I said, since the Civil War. And these homes have stayed in these families since that time. And they're just such a wonderful part of our community. And we've had such wonderful relationships ever since. But they had their own exhibits of things from their homes. And then we had the local exhibits and pictures. And so as a result of all of that, Dr. Burden and my uncle started talking about, you know, the old turnpike that went through here. And Charles Burden, who's the retired professor from Georgia State, he asked me, he said, do you think your uncle would lead us along the old turnpike road? And so I asked my uncle, Doug Pace, and he said, sure. He said, I know where it goes because he used to do a lot of hiking and a lot of hunting old bottles and things like that. And so we started section by section hiking the old roadbed. Sometimes we were actually jumping over streams and, you know, crawling under fences and things like that. But we hiked it with a GPS, with another lady was with us. Her name is Brenda Wiley, and she took her GPS tracker and recorded our steps. And then Charles's wife, Brenda, Elka also went with us for a lot of these hikes. And we recorded it as we walked. And then we were able, with the help of the State Highway Department, to get that overlaid onto a current map. And so we will have in the book the overlay to show where the old turnpike went versus where 276 is today. But also we have some of the history of a lot of the history of Cedar Mountain and Buck Forest and Caesar's Head, and even some of like the Guns Rock community as you go into Brevard. As you go out the road, we will talk about the homes, the businesses, all of those things from the 1800s and the early 1900s. And then lots and lots of photographs that people have been sharing with us of the old homes and the old businesses and the old bridges and the old hotels that were in this area, some of the older families like the Solomon Jones family, some of those, you know, that we have pictures. We'll share all of those and just share with people what Cedar Mountain was like in the Civil War, as you and I have discussed today. Some of that right. knowledge came out of those research, you know, opportunities. And we're calling it The Village in the Turnpike, a whimsical Cedar Mountain historical adventure. And it's kind of a light approach in a way, as you mm-hmm. read it, to some of the things that happened and the things that changed. And we deal with we touch on the Native American aspect, which you and I haven't discussed, but the Cherokee were in this area using it for hunting grounds and many, and harvesting. They would come to harvest things. But we have plenty of artifacts from their time here in Cedar Mountain. And then the drovers being a big part of the discussion, too. And then, of course, the hotels and the possibility that the railroad was going to come. And the camps for children and for the mill camps, the textile mill camps that were up here in Cedar Mountain. We discussed those and have pictures of those. And just the churches and the schools and the stores. And, you know, we touch on all of that stuff and try to put pictures of all those places. And our plan is that it will be published by next summer and available. And the three of us have, you know, worked on it together. And it's been a lot of fun. But I've learned a lot more about my community than I ever knew. My mother was the one that really got me started with the history because she loved it. And she, before there was ever an internet, she was searching everywhere and saving newspaper articles and traveling. And then Alton and Billy Taylor that did all the work on the cemetery. They were others that also got out there in their cars and traveled to all these government offices and libraries and newspapers to accumulate this information. And so we owe a lot to them and to John Carney for his work out at Buck Forest to compile this stuff. And then we've been able to, you know, accumulate more as the years have gone by, and especially now with Ancestry and, you know, all these records being put on digitized, right. You know, it makes it so much easier than for them. So it's been a lot of fun, and people have been so gracious to share family stories and documents and pictures, especially photographs, that, you know, we look forward to getting it out there so everybody can enjoy it.
Well, awesome. And when it becomes available, I would love to chat with you again, Patty. And beyond that, I would like to chat with you again about some of the other history that's out there in Western North Carolina, because it's just fascinating. Again, I just get blown away when I walk out into the forest to take some photographs, because I'm a natural world photographer and wildlife photographer. But when I'm out there and I stumble across, let's say, a cemetery or an old foundation to a home, or I see an old barn right. kind of falling apart, and I think, what happened here?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. then my mind just starts to wonder. And I got to be honest with you, my imagination isn't as good as the stories that I discover when I start digging.
Yeah. I know. We just we can't invent some of the stuff that happened to people, can we?
No, and
we have to.
Well, right. From your great 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 grandfather to Civil War heroes to all the different things that you discover and find, you go, wow.
Yeah, and we didn't even talk about the Walton War, which of course was a big part. This area was in the middle of that Walton War territory, which is something else that would be for another discussion. But it right. was the early 1800s, you know, up until 1818 or so, that this area was an area of debate: who owned it, North Carolina, South Carolina, or Georgia? And there was, there were deeds being written in both North Carolina and Georgia claiming this area here until it was finally settled. That's an entirely different story that books have been written about, and that's very interesting. But it added to some of the confusion when you're researching and you see that someone here claims something about Georgia. You have to think, oh dear, was this during the time of the Walton War, which was really more of a skirmish? It wasn't right. actually a war, but did this happen during that time period? If it did, that may be why I'm getting Georgia or South Carolina instead of North Carolina for Cedar Mountain. So lots of stuff out there to explore for sure.
Well, I promise you, you'll be a guest on this podcast again.
Okay.
Because I'd love to hear. I'd love to hear about the Walton War. That sounds fascinating. I know that there was that swath of land there that the three states fought over.
The Orphan Strip, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
And so I want to learn more about that as well, because when you're out there walking through those areas, you can think, man, bloodshed was over this little piece of land. So it's really interesting. But again, Patty, thank you so much for your time today. Again, Patty Stahl is our guest. And how can they get in touch with you if they want to go out and take one of the tours with the graveyards or even just through the DuPont State Forest with you all?
Yeah, that I think the easiest way to do that, our hikes are sponsored by the Friends of DuPont Forest. And they list them when we're able to do them again. Mm-hmm. They will have them in their newsletter or on their website, and you can go on there and sign up. We do try to keep the groups, fairly small so that we can make it more of an intimate discussion, as we go into the cemeteries. We do lead trips to the Hooker Moore Cemetery, but also the Thomas Cemetery, which we really didn't discuss. That's a longer hike. You know how far it is into the Hooker uh-huh. Moore Cemetery. It just takes you a few minutes.
Yeah.
But the hike into the Thomas Cemetery is, I've never actually measured it, but it takes probably a half an hour or more to walk into there. It's out near the Guyon Farm area.
Okay.
You access it from the Guyon Farm. We start there at the Guyon Farm parking lot and go from there. And it's a fairly level hike also. But and we talk a lot about the history of the Thomas family as we go to that one, because that's also their neck of the woods, as we say, where their homes were out in that area. So, that's really how you would sign up for one of our hikes, is to go on to the Friends of DuPont site or with their newsletter and find out when they're not offered yet. We'll have to see, what they're doing for next year. We
right.
usually do one in the spring and one in the fall. And then for the festival, which is something fairly new, the DuPont State Recreational Forest Festival, we've also done some hikes, short hikes up to the cemeteries with that. Or there's also been a historical booth there that the Pennsylvania County Library would have some exhibits, of historical things that happened out there, and people couldn't come to that also. There again, we were not able to do that this year because of COVID, but hopefully, soon we'll be back to all of those things.
Well, hopefully soon, and maybe even this summer, if they have that vaccination distributed and everyone gets it, and at least 75% of the population, I think I read earlier
right.
today, needs to get it so that we can get back to normalcy, and I'm all about that.
Yeah, me too. And those are outdoor events, which makes it nice also, even safer because they're outdoor events.
Right. And Patty, again, thank you so much for your time.
You are welcome.
Explore with RWD. We'll be right back after this.
It seemed bleak for the colonists to be able to establish their own country during the American Revolutionary War. The British were winning until the British made a fatal mistake and threatened the wrong people. And Western North Carolinian historian Bill Carson from the Orchard at Alta Pass shares that story during episode 2 of Explore with RWD. Listen directly after this podcast.
Welcome back to Explore with RWD.
Again, I want to thank Patty Stahl for being our guest today and sharing all of those stories about not only her family, but also the community that was in Buck Forest, or AKA the DuPont State Recreational Forest, as it's called today. Again, I'm Roger W. Downs, your host, and I want to thank you personally for listening. Please, if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to this podcast, and we'll bring you more stories of the people and places that we discover. And if you get a chance to, check us out online at explorewithrwd.com to see some of the photos of those places and to read the articles as well. And please share those with your friends on social media. I'd much appreciate you. And, one last thing. We'll also make sure to put links so you can find more about the DuPont State Forest and also friends of the DuPont State Forest and possibly schedule a tour with Patty or one of her associates to go out into the cemeteries and learn more about the history of Western North Carolina. Now, look, if no one else has told you this yet today, I love you, and I know the good Lord above loves you. He has promised you that, so make sure to count your blessings, because even in these tough times, God is good, and he's working miracles. He's spinning it out of the darkness. He's always putting that silver lining in the gray cloud. He's always done it for me, and he'll always do it for you. And remember, you are forgiven. All you need to do is ask, and he will separate your sin from you as far as the east is from the west. So until next time, peace, love, and coon dogs, y'all.
Thank you for listening. Visit us online at explorewithrwd.com to discover more about Roger, his photography, podcast, and adventures. Or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. At Explore with RWD. Remember, we didn't inherit the earth from our parents. We borrow it from our children. May God bless you and yours. Now get outside and go explore. Explore with RWD is produced by Downs Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.